Welcome to Crane Radio. Celebrate a life well lived.
Welcome to this first season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. I have invited the most powerful, eclectic and woke shamanic folk I know to talk with me about their take on shamanism and tap you straight into the minds and hearts of those who are the real deal 21st century shamans. Real people, real stories and a whole lot of mind-blowing, spirit-stirring juju. Patrick van den Broek is a Belgian anthropologist specializing in Javanese culture and spirituality. He has a BA in anthropology from University of Illinois at Chicago, USA, and a master's in cultural anthropology from Leiden University in the Netherlands. Having spent nearly 15 years in residence in Yogyakarta province, Patrick has accumulated specialized knowledge in various aspects of the spirituality, culture, history, and ancient literature of Java, deepening himself in ancient sources to help explain the contemporary manifestations of traditional and authentic Javanese culture and practices. He's preparing a doctoral research PhD in the same vein and shares his passions and knowledge through lectures, exhibitions, and guided tours through circuits connecting ancient sites dotting the central and east Javanese landscape. Patrick, it's a pleasure to have you on our first season of The Modern Crone, the 21st Century Shaman. Thank you for joining.
Thank you, and it's a pleasure for me to be here.
It's nice to see you, actually, because we haven't been over to Java since COVID, and it's been a couple of years now, hasn't it, really? Nearly?
Yeah. It's almost 2 years. Yeah, you're right.
Almost 2 years. Incredible. So, Patrick, let's just jump straight into the topic for the season. So as an anthropologist who's spent most of his adult life actually studying and living and working with Javanese shaman, how would you define shamanism?
So from my experience and my arbitrary understanding of shamanism, and this I derive, as you say, from direct experience with Javanese shamans and a bit in Nepal, in the Himalayas. I've also touched upon, you could say, Himalayan shamanism, but also from readings and treatises on shamanism beyond in the Americas, in Africa, in Siberia, places where contemporary shamans still operate, transmit, and teach their, you could say, their science, because I call it a science.
Yeah.
From what I gathered, and also you might know that I until COVID, I received the visits often of French and Canadian Quebec shamans that mostly are versed in the traditions of North African and South American and Central American types of shamanism. So we've had very interesting, you could say, discussions and correlations with the Javanese form of shamanism, or you could say Southeast Asian. And so what I derive from it in very simple terms is that a shaman is a person who with a simple mundane or material or intellectual means of understanding life and the sources of that life. Yeah. And hence, if I state it like that, it would start with one human's own life. So it's very closely connected to what we call the self-realization techniques or paths, about understanding oneself better. And through the understanding of oneself at a different level, then maybe also make correlations about the existence of the other. And the other can be other humans or whatever situation, animal or being is being perceived by the five senses. And then even beyond that, more into what we call the universal forces, that are all also perceptible, like weather and rain and the climate, and you could say tectonic forces, meaning that they're more impending on the existence of nature itself.
Yep.
And so the shaman will always attempt to have a more holistic experience in terms of receiving the truth of the existence of a subject. And as I say, starting with oneself, so starting with the self. For that, techniques of consciousness alteration, or you could say alternative consciousness patterns, will be necessary in this. But in the end, what I feel is that the phenomena that is being touched is always the same, meaning an energetic first, an energetic plane of existence between humans, being everything, basically, whatever in the universe contains, you could say, a pattern, a structure, an algorithm of energies.
Yep.
And so this would be the first level to start grasping a more wholesome or holistic image of the subject, whatever subject, is through the energetic approach. And so here in Java, this is very, very clearly so. And this is also how they teach young people first, what they call the Kanoman, the first stage of spiritual approaches to life, is through understanding the energy basis of life. So, and starting always by Jati Dhiri. Dhiri means oneself, the one's own perceiver, and understanding the perceiver first in its energetic, you could say, capacities and possibilities.
And makeup, And something really common, I think, that you can see in all forms of shamanism around the world is this vow, in some cases, of service to others. So even though what you've described can almost seem like a sort of a soul journey of understanding the self fully, the spiritual causal dynamics that bring us as a phenomena and all the phenomena that we perceive to bear. But in the end, does that journey ultimately take you back to service?
From my experience, I can say this is a long path, that, and it's different from one person to another.
Yeah.
Meaning not automatically. That would be the short answer.
Not automatically, okay.
The short answer, if I continue, is because I've seen black magic and sorcery at play, that basically at the energy level, this is only the second level, so going from the mundane and scientific, you could say, and analytical or intellectual kind of grasping of things, then there's the second way, is the energetic grasping or encounter or interaction with things. Even at that second level, I would say it's still neutral of morality or ethics. So I mean, anyone, even with bad intentions, could do that self-realization of his own energetic capacities and manipulations.
Okay.
If it wasn't so, we wouldn't have trouble healing people from, you know, black magic or spells and so on, curses. Now, this is also something I strongly believe in. I've seen it firsthand. I mean, I'm an assistant for a dukun here, so I know from experience that energy can be mishandled. It's not yet of service necessarily. But if you go beyond, if you start understanding the sources of life and going back more to origins and causality, that's where, you start grasping the laws. There is a certain set of regulations and rules, which we call the karmic cycles of basically the universal law, or hukum alam, the natural law, not human made, and it cannot be tampered with by humans. And when you start understanding these, like impermanence and karma, causality and consequence, that's when it is becoming for sure that the soul, that it becomes a soul journey that can not be achieved in any other way than to be of service to others.
Yeah.
So that's when the topics of morality, empathy, compassion, and ethics is very important, and also loyalty to this system of law, to this universal law. That's when service cannot be anything but the outcome. So it's a higher level, I would say.
It's a higher level. So in the Buddhism and the Hindu frameworks, this is really non-duality, isn't it? Oneness consciousness. Yes. So you sort of understand the source, and then your only response, knowing that everything is all part of you, is to help, isn't it?
Yeah. In Mahayana Buddhism, or what I followed, I mean, I almost became a monk in the Mahayana, Vajrayana, Tantrayana traditions with Tibetans. And they kept repeating to me at every single either teaching or even guided meditation that Buddhism is all about two pillars. And he says every spirituality should have that. The two pillars are one, wisdom, and the other pillar is compassion.
Yeah.
Or it can be translated as empathy, the willingness to serve also others, or to care for others' well-being. And he said, and they keep saying the two pillars are there because one pillar cannot stand without the other, and they mutually reinforce or should support each other. That's why you can go really far in wisdom, but if you use that wisdom as just a new weapon,
yeah,
to cause ruin. And so that's where you get to the vows. That's why we have the vows. We have to do the five seals or the five vows of any lay people into spiritual. Then there's more vows for the bodhisattva levels. Yep. But the five vows are simple, and they're, I would say, universal for almost all ancestral teachings. Is do not steal, do not kill, do not cause harm or ruin somebody by malevolency or malignancy, do not lie, and do not cause adultery, which is an interesting one, this don't cause adultery, which is basically another way of form of lying, is breaking someone's trust.
Yeah, and vows, breaking a vow. Yeah, so the understanding of the power of a vow is paramount in this. Yeah. And you talk about this too, like in our previous conversations, you've talked about there's the laboratory. That may be your framework of study. That might be the path that you're with your guru or teacher or whatever it may be. But the main game is the embodiment and then your unique refraction of that. Is that? Yeah. Can you tell us a bit more about that? So is it important to have this balance, if you like, between work in the lab and work out in the field? How does that work for you?
It's all a question about, all right, people who learn, the manners of learning anything, really. I mean, you can be in the lab where you basically keep getting what we say ilmu, or knowledge, and through hearing, through reading, and through toying around with techniques. But unless you bring all of that to life and to conventional life, and that's what we call the application, and the result of the application, good or and bad, I was not good say good or bad, but good and bad, will determine the truth of whatever theory, whatever practice you've been taught.
Yeah.
And so it is only in practice that we can actually, you could say, confirm the legitimacy, I would say, or the appropriateness, or the power even of a certain ilmu or of a certain technique, because it is now then brought to life, the current and the cycles of outside life, which is beyond our control most of the time.
Yeah.
So we then prove then the efficiency of the actual theory. So it is this is why I call the lab and the application field. The lab is, for instance, the gompa or the vihara or the your own little shrine or whatever temple like go to. But life is not encapsulated in that temple or that shrine or that church or that mosque or that, you know,
yeah.
It can never be, because life outside is chaotic and you can't control it. It's beyond your control. So for me, the lab can only prepare you, but what really confirms and what really, what we say sharpens the knife, mangasa. So mangasa means to sharpen the tool, the yeah. tools that you get in the lab, but the only way to sharpen them will never be in the lab. Yeah. It can only be by approaching, attacking life almost, yeah, grasping yeah. life.
To put them to use.
Yeah, in that sense, yeah. you do, we use the image of the warrior, because if you look also again in shamanism, there's always this image of the warrior, because it is a combat. There is risks, there are fears, there is doubt.
Yep.
There's also all over the other types of enemy. There's enemies of the path, but these need to be you could say apprehended. They need to be embraced.
Yeah.
Very valiantly, and that's the bravery of a Kshatriya, that he doesn't hide away from these things. But you cannot find them in the lab. These temptation and risk and dangers. You can only find them in real life, in conventional life, and that's why. But also, you asked me about Java. In Java, it's very, you could say, you know, the paradigm is very yin yang, black and white. And so they never negate the darkness. They never negate the blackness. They never negate the buruk, meaning the unperfect, imperfect. They use it to determine and to confirm the truth of life. I'm always very, very skeptical, hence, of traditions that are too positivistic, too holy, too white, and try to skim away, do without, or ignore the darkness. I simply don't think it's a very apt picture of reality, that's all. It doesn't prepare as well.
Yeah, I agree. What this framework that you're talking about has come up over and over again in these podcasts, that the real game of, well, any spiritual inquiry, but we're particularly talking about shamanism, is to bring it down to the earth, is to ground it. And the way that you're describing the Javanese framework is just beautiful, because what it's really doing is reinstating the mundane as equally as sacred as the temple or the temple work. Whereas I think a lot of New Age, you know, a lot of the New Age commentary on spiritual inquiry is all love and light and, you know, this sort of seeking this permanent state of bliss, but that's not the game. Yeah. So you've mentioned just, you know, in previous responses in this podcast that you've, you know, you've, your own personal framework is steeped in, you know, understanding of Buddhism, Taoist practice, you know, Hinduism framework and so on. And you've really, you've spent time with the true teachings on location, but a lot of that, you're also Bodhisattva vowed, you're a master of breath work, you're a yogi. How much would you say, and you have talked about this, the mastery of the self, the understanding of the own energy body, how much of that is important to be able to engage with the shamanistic path? Is that where people should start?
It is necessary to start getting interested if you want to engage with shamanism. Now, shamanism, as very clear, is a very general kind of generic kind of word, because there's a lot of variants. Yeah. But as I say, even though if you look through the variants and the techniques and the cultures and the artistic, you could culture that is woven around all the different shamanism from the world.
Yep.
The phenomena is always the same. The outcome is always a contact and a download and a manipulation of forces and phenomena that is the same source. This is what we call the universe or the natural source. In Shivaism, we call them the Kadewatan, the Dewa dimensions.
Yep.
You know, in Buddhism, there which is something of the omniscient mind, which is empty. But full at the same time, infinitely
yeah.
full.
Yeah.
And so on. So, but I think for someone to want as a beginner, maybe to try to engage even through books and readings, you have to start getting interested in looking at yourself at somebody beyond a mere material body, yeah, and intellectual body. So hence for that, for instance, I can, there are systems that have been, you could say, created to explain that. Now start getting interested, for instance, in what they call the seven chakras, you know.
Yep.
The seven chakras, again, even though not all traditions in the world use the word chakra, but the seven nodes of energy and bodies, as we call the astral bodies, will be constantly in very similar terms being described in almost all traditions. And so if you ask me, I would say, so the seven chakra theories and philosophies of one's body, and make sure that when you read or get transmission on the seven chakras, they talk about you. It's about a self-discovery. It can, don't be interested in the outer world at that point. Try to find yourself, because these are the tools that we use to then explore the outer. So it what we call the micro and the macro, you know, and the unity will happen later. The unity of the macrocosmic mind and the micro mind, so that non-dualistic kind of union, the Atman meeting the Brahman, or getting sucked into the Brahman.
The Tantra, yeah.
Yeah, you can read about it, but don't be too enamored, because the base practices for shamanism, to start understanding real shamanic practitioners, like the Dukuns I work with and the masters that I work with, is to first come and start understanding the explanation of oneself. Because every shamanic healer and master will always apprehend someone from his own body and from his own ways of understanding. And so for you to start having a bridge of understanding is to minimally start grasping about your own energy body. That's the portal. We talk about the fourth chakra. And so a lot of practices will be dealing with what they call the prana body, the chi body, prana or chi. Here we call it tanaga dalam. Now the plexus chakra is the center of knowledge. So stay there and try to understand it fully, and in the terms of its capacities and faculties and, you know, ways of, manipulating that energy.
Yep.
And at that point, you will probably get a download. And this, again, is very universal on the five elements. Because when we talk about prana, chi, or any type of energy, it is broken down in five. Not in terms of the Mendeleev table in chemistry tables, like the 108 elements, but we talk about five elements only. And so seven chakras, five elements. And then later we can start going into more, you could say, divine or outer interactions, I would say. But let's stay with humans first. I mean, humans trying to understand life should first understand humanity, I would say. To then have a scope or a lens to start understanding gradually other forms of life and the sources of life themselves.
Tired of working from home? Maybe you're just looking to add some scenery to your morning commute. Instead of just walking from your room to your bathroom to your kitchen to your room, add a stop at Crane, where you can work, play, dine, shop, and socialize within restrictions at $99 a month.
Yeah, and some of in my perspective, and certainly in my practice as well, I think part of what you're talking about in understanding the resonance and the intelligence of the subtle body or the pranic body or chi body is to sort of loosen our reliance on the critical mind, isn't it? So we have such a linear way of thinking about time, space, phenomenon, but to really tap that expanded awareness of the causal plane of existence, you need to move beyond thought, really, don't you? And it's the energy body that allows us to do that. It's a felt intelligence.
Yeah, well, I think it's all related. So in many shamanic traditions, like the Javanese or the Shivaism or Tantrayana, there. And this is why I do talk about the seven chakras, because here in these systems here, they have a very low level for intellectuality or emotional, what we call the first physical capacities, the body, the, you know, the bodybuilding power type of power, or power based on physical strength. That's the first one. It's linked to the Muladhara. Then you have IQ or Akal, as they call it here, the intellectual analytical capacities of someone. That's only the second level.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking out of seven here. It's only number two.
Yeah.
You know, and then comes the emotional EQ, the emotional. That's only number three.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say, like, start getting interested in something more supreme, more perfect or more powerful. It's the number four, the plexus. So that's where they state, that's the energy apprehension, energy body apprehension. Not that we can do without the first three, and that's, there's no talk about throwing the baby with the bathwater, or what you say, the constricting or critical, analytical, intellectual way of looking at things. We don't throw that away, but we'd like to be more informed in our patterns of intellectuality, and be more precise and more proportional, maybe, or more adapted to the subject. So these then tools, the physical, the intellectual, the emotional, will then be more informed in terms of their grasping and their processing of the truth. And so by a higher form of, and that's where in Buddhism, they always say, they always give this image of the intellectual mind and the body as a big elephant.
Yeah.
And the mind is the rider. The mind is the one that tries to guide the elephant. So mind always precedes body. It shouldn't be the other way. Problems occur when the body and the three lower bodies guide or pull the mind in a certain direction. That's when you could say accidents can happen, or misunderstanding can happen.
Well, and this is really the illusion of the modern age too, isn't it? Like, it's so pegged on the material. But what I want to do, what I'd love to talk about with you, Patrick, is some of the work you're doing on the ground there in Java. So you work alongside local shaman healers particularly, and you've shared with me that, you know, in that work you've witnessed what some may regard as really miraculous healings. And so could you give us an example, obviously keeping anonymity paramount, but could you give us an example of what some of these local shaman have been that you've witnessed can achieve with their work?
So my role as an anthropologist, simply an observer or a voyeur, I could say a voyeur of these type of ritual practices and healing. I mean, that started to not stop, but going a bit on the background in 2009, because starting in 2009, I started sharing. And now, not in a role of just merely an anthropologist, but basically a broker or an access door, an assistant to access this world. So that's when I invited people to learn about it or to come and get benefits of it, so healing. So patients would come and students. That's why I called it the Javanese Wisdom and Healing Project, because some people would come to learn wisdom, but even more so would come, you know, as patients, bringing their problems here, you know, and looking for a healing. So in that sense, I started also becoming a broker or an assistant and a connector to my gurus, to my masters, not to the whole vast system of Kajawan in itself, because me, myself, you know, it's a work of trust to who to work with, you know, and in terms of masters, I choose them carefully. And I've only basically have worked in trust with five gurus.
Okay.
Of which three of them, or what, four of them, but one died now in the meantime. But three of them I use, and I expose them to to foreigners, because the two other ones are just way too out there.
Okay.
And they're not socially very viable.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to be prepared. That's somebody that I would introduce beginners to.
Yeah.
Also, what they sometimes can be very boom, shocking. But in any case, the first three, so I've known them and I worked with them at least, you know, one of them with 23 years and the other two I worked since 2013, 2014.
Amazing.
When I started bringing people to them. So examples, well, I always say in the 23 years that I've started to penetrate this world of ritual and healing and observing it in the first step, then since 2009, as I say, being a middleman, yep. being a middleman in the actual consultations or operations, whatever you want to call it, I've seen some strange shit for sure.
Well, give us some examples.
Yeah, so, a lot of cancers that were basically neutralized at the level where they were,
yeah.
and not stopped in right there in their tracks. You know, cancers, neutralization of Lyme disease,
yeah.
which almost every doctor will tell you once you have it, you can't get rid of it.
Yeah.
kind of like herpes, you know.
Yeah.
All right, so you can stop that right in their tracks, basically kill it in within the system and then purge it. Hepatitis C cases that were just stopped in their tracks, you know, which means after that, when they go back to an echography or sampling by doctors, by allopathic doctors, they can't find traces.
Yeah,
it's a mystery where the bug went. You know.
Yeah, it's a miracle.
Same with cancers that were in stage 2 or 3, and they were. Every scientific doctor would say, well, it's going to metastasize and there's nothing we can do about it, because these are cases that had already gone through 1 or 2 chemotherapies or radiation therapies. So there's basically always cases. I mean, the most crazy cases of success is always in terminal disease where doctors lift their hands, basically.
Yeah.
And so... And in that sense, the patients we had were from all strata, you know, and there was a lot of people that came from very, you know, able society, I would say, you know, like they were able to pay for the most expensive treatments, you know, and had gone through them, but still had the problem living. So that's when I bring them to Masjoko or somebody else. And by miracle, somehow there's a success there. Like right now, we're working on some cases, especially since COVID. I touched upon this earlier before COVID, but since COVID, because of the inability of these patients to come, we are forced to do a lot of astral intervention. Okay. So at a distance.
Yeah. So this is, we've talked about this before, haven't we? Because this is the, as you know, I'm an energy healer, and this is an aspect of the modality that I use as well. And it's become a big feature of my offering because of COVID, and that's this ability to generate
to meet directly.
Yeah, and so, but also the absolute reality that an astral connection can be made and healing can be administered across time and place. So, you know, how does that? Oh God, I've got so many questions, but how does that work with your shamans? So do they, you know, do they enter ritual? Is it a trance state?
Yeah.
Do you line up the recipient of the healing to be in the same at least time zone, or that doesn't matter? What does it look like?
All of that, all of the above. Uh-huh. I mean, we start to put it simple. Masjoko, the Dukun will. All right, there's any type of case, any type of questioning, any type of problem, he will ask for a picture, a selfie, a facial picture with the eyes open of the inquirer, the requester, person with the problem. Name, surname, and date of birth, and then also the address where he or she is presently resided, located. And so he gets, so like everything, he does a diagnosis, the diagnostic first, the detection. So that he can do in 1 hour or less than that. He can do it just looking at the picture.
Okay.
Of what, so then people are, I mean, people, we don't look at the bad, the goods and the talents. We don't look at the goods, the good things. So everything that's working well doesn't need to be talked about unless they want to. But he will then specifically see an aura that is an alarm of something not right.
Okay, incredible. And
now cases can differ. They can either tell us what the problem is, the symptom of what they have gone through and what doctors are finding, or they can keep it completely unsaid, but they know something's wrong and they ask the dukun what is wrong with them. So in both cases, he will detect what is, and usually what he comes up with is a causality of a causality, a primal causality.
Yeah.
Because symptoms for them are just signals and alarms of something deeper, something more essential that needs to be corrected. And so he usually goes and will say, look, sometimes it cannot be understood by the patient itself, what's wrong with them. It also depends. I mean, it can be physical, physical, and it can be also energetical problem. And the worst ones are possessions, where the mind is now, the mind of a person is not speaking for himself, but there's a, you could say, a succubus or
entity.
An entity who's basically replying to the reading.
Yeah.
And so they're really dangerous because we speak, this is not just bipolarism. These are possessed people basically. And they carry with them an entity which is feeding upon the highest level, which is their own minds. If it's just using their bodies as a physical vehicle, that's one thing. But if the mind is already being repressed there, and then it's very dangerous, because we have to make sure about who's answering to us.
Absolutely. Patrick, Java is striking because of its natural elements. You know, you're surrounded by, you live on a volcano for a start, and it's a super active island.
On an active volcano.
Oh, I know, it's rumbling, isn't it? But it's also really known for its just incredible sacred sites. It's temples, Borobudur, there's Prabhanam. Within the shamanic framework and and your understanding, how important is connection with the land, connection with these ley lines, these energetic hotspots for the shamanic path? Can you tell us a little bit more about your understanding of that?
Sure. I think to understand that, I would invite the reader or the listener to interest themselves a little bit more into the five element structure.
Yeah.
You know, this whole system of organizing energy systems is always in five, or four and five, four in the center. And you know, there's a Chinese, traditional Chinese medicine manuals for that, or the pranic, mostly Indianized system, the prana systems for that. And,
yep.
Because if I talk about Tanaga Dalam and the energy of land and the way it is, you could say, consciously recognizable by a microcosm like a human, and the macrocosm of the land, you need to have a certain cosmological understanding of these five elements. That is the binding, because it is said the land and objects like volcanoes, but also a temple where they buried a pancha dhatu, which are powerful objects that emanate. And many of these temples and many of these shrines are still buried under the land of Java. Central Java and East Java is full of these power spots that have been built, and some of them have never been built. So we have these ancient ancestral sanctuaries. Could not be understood without a little bit of an understanding of the concept of the five elements. The five elements, fire, water, earth, and wind, are both within us and both in the universe. And we are bonded to the universe by it. And so without it, life cannot be really completely or fully or holistically explained.
Yeah.
And so we survive from nature or the universe through these channels of the five. This is how we are nourished. This is also when, in terms of disharmony, we'll feel sick. Too much fire, not enough land, or too much water and not enough wind, and that kind of. So this is all explained very well. Now, for me, this is crucial. We don't need to go into other complicated types of explanations with strange words. This is the crux of the matter.
Yep.
This is where we speak about alignment and nourishment and harmony, and you could say absorptions. This is how it starts. So to come back to your question, the land of Java, where I live, there are sites where these five elements have been, you could say, compressed or concentrated to a level that is beyond the ordinary. And you can readily feel that. Now, this is why, for instance, there's so many sacred springs here, because they've been sacralized for so long, for generations. I'm not going to say something, but at least for 1,000 years, if not 2,000 years, if not longer, the way we start discovering civilization here in Java and linking it back to Atlantis. I'm not going to go into that topic and Lemuria, but anyway, it can be very long, where some of these sites have been approached, worshipped, and where energy was, you could say, requested or taken or invoked, but also where energy was brought by humans in terms of offerings, in terms of, all sorts of rituals.
Yeah.
And so some of these sites, you can readily feel that their vibration is very high and have been for a very long time. So, and as I say, many of these sites are still buried. So that means I'm not surprised that the land of Java as a whole is completely sacralized from West Java all the way to East Java, because evidence of history, historical evidence, have shown us of consecutive, very religious dynasties and Dewa Rajas with their cohorts of clergy and rishis, that where every mountain, every spring, almost every river, every coast was sacralized by these people.
But I think what that translates to, this beautiful framework that you're describing is just on the ground, and which is observable by someone like me who comes to visit and who would love to come and visit soon, is just a beautiful reverence. There's a beautiful reverence that you see around not just the temples, but also just the approach to life. There is generally, in my observation and the locals that we know and that we work with when we're there, is an awareness that it's more than the mundane, So it seems to be cultural, this shamanic view, as well as just pertaining to the...
You are correct.
Yeah.
And I've often been asked how Buddhist and Shivaist, that we don't see anymore so much practice, but... core values and morality and ethical teachings have been still being, you could say, implemented by the people of Java today.
Yeah.
Even though the religion and the doctrines are not as present as what we see in Bali. Key to know is that wayang, and you know the wayang, the shadow puppet, and the dances that are related to the wayang.
Yep.
All right. So they still tell all philosophies and all good versus bad habits. Even stories tell about Tapa Brata, the supernatural powers of these power. Now, these stories are still being performed, told, recited, and they're still very much aware, the Javanese, of these teachings, even though they're not taught in because Islam doesn't teach. Well, Islam teaches its own set of morality. So by all means, and also in Java, you have to know the Islam that is in majority taught here is Sufistic or Sufi Islam. Yeah. And so it's very mystical, which embraces a lot of the old ideas. So a lot of these Muslims here have one foot in the Quran, but they also have another foot in their Javanese kind of mystical, and it is in place, and they still hold a lot of, you could say, respect and honor to these ancient Wayang, you know, sets of values, because they know, because it's exactly this, they bring it to life and life will tell them about advantage or misfortune.
Yeah.
And they always relate back to karma and, you know, they've broken some kind of rule, and they always have acted badly. And they always talk about that, even to the point, they always, you could say, stoically face problems by explaining it out in a very spiritual way. It's always the case.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you will see people who are stressed, like the young generations or people who do not believe anymore. They become really stressed, like, and depressed, like we find in the West. But otherwise, Javanese are very stoic. They have a very quick way of admitting, and you could say, looking for purification. They admit to their own problems.
They
don't blame it to others. And they seek redemption. And the way they seek redemption is through the Dukun or through these masters.
They
will go to the South Coast. They will go to the mountain and they will say, please, please, I know I've done bad. I will change.
Yeah.
And it's very, very, I mean, you could call it folkloric or superstitious, but I tell you what, I've been here long enough and I followed these people close enough that success follows. A level of harmony is attained after that.
And
it does help them. And that's why it perpetuates itself, because without results and without evidence, of course, this would just vanish a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it doesn't.
I mean,
it delivers, you know, the system delivers. So that's why it keeps.
That's why it prevails. Yeah, amazing.
And I've learned a lot of that, like looking at their suffering. As I told you before, I was also involved in NGOs and humanitarian disaster work here for three, four years. So I know quite a lot about, you know, the way Javanese take on suffering, like, you know, the earthquakes of Java in 2006 and the eruptions of the Merapi 2010 and also in Padang in West Sumatra. I have a lot of experience about how they deal with suffering, and it's very impressive, very impressive.
Yeah, it's beautiful. Yeah, it's but like you said, you know, I mean, you could ask the question, is it their belief in the system which is what generates the reestablishment of harmony, or is it the system that they're believing in, or is it both? That's the ultimate question, I guess, isn't it? Is it?
I would say this, hukum alam, universal law, you know?
Yeah.
It will impose itself upon you, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
Whether you believe it or it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because you will come victim to it, or you will benefit from it.
Yeah.
And we can go on and on about that, but that's basically what they're learning here. You know, the Hasta Brata, try to be in line with a universal law.
Yeah.
These are not laws that are made by humans, cannot be tainted, changed by humans. They cannot try to pay their way out of it. You cannot be... You know, it's like you can buy everything with a MasterCard, but that you cannot buy. You know?
Yeah, so you may as well learn what they are and align yourself with them. Yeah.
And so the system has a way to impose itself, whether you like it or not. And I tell you what, it's not just a Javanese thing. I mean, this is by definition or by default true for the rest of the world globally.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And we're kind of going through that. But I'm not going to go into that with COVID.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That'll be a subject of another podcast. Patrick, I could talk to you all day, but I think we should wrap it up here. But thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us your immense knowledge of shamanism, and particularly and specifically life and culture and spirituality in Java. I'm super grateful. So thank you so much.